Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. Today, I always almost say the same thing, don't I? Today, we have another special guest, Dr. Ira Shore, and he is going to help us kick off a new series that we'll have episodes running throughout the rest of this year called Legends in the Long War for the Soul and Survival of Public Education. He is indeed a legend. And before I bring him on, I got to do a couple housekeeping things first. One, we want to shout out to all the parents, the students, and the community in Chicago that are supporting the efforts of those who are on the hunger strike to protect their beloved high school from being taken over and probably turned over to charter schools. This is happening in Chicago. The strike started about the middle of the week, and they pledge to stay there until they get a decision as to whether or not their school is going to be taken over or will be allowed to remain as the only public high school, open enrollment high school in their community. So I wanted to make sure we get a shout out to them and let them know that we are aware of the situation and we support them 100%. Secondly, I also want to say thanks to several hundred people who took the time and effort to wish me a happy birthday. My birthday was 3 days ago, and I was shocked and blown away again by the fact that people are aware of it, but also the volume of happy birthday greetings that I got. And I want everyone to know, yes, I am slowly but surely sending everyone a thank you note. It's going to take me a little while, but I'm doing it. Now, let's get to it. I'm going to introduce Dr. Shore. Ira,
yes,
welcome
yes.
to the...
Good morning. Good
welcome
afternoon.
Welcome to the War Report.
Thanks, and please call me Ira. Yes, everybody
okay,
call
welcome
me Ira.
To, okay, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
I said legend, and I said you were a prime example of what I had in mind of a legend. Let's go back to some years ago and bring people up to date as to who you are and what you've done that would make you a legend. Now, I don't want to put you on a spot. I'm the one that's calling you the legend.
Right.
So let's okay. start with you telling us about you.
Okay. I'm very honored and grateful that you should ask me to speak with you on this program. I don't consider myself a legend. I'm just a professor, and I've published a bunch of books, and I speak at conferences and things like that. And I started. I was at the 1963 march with Dr. King. That's where I got started when I was 18 years old. So, lots of folks, I've been marching for a very long time for a variety of courses and causes. And I, in the few minutes I was listening to you, James, I wrote down the names of folks who are my heroes and who I honor for extraordinary contributions in this terrible war, this private war on public education that we've been aging for the last 10 years or so. And, you know, I put Karen Lewis at the top of the list because of her incredible contribution to the students and families of Chicago. And then under that, I put Diane Ravitch for reasons folks, I'm sure, know, and how she's been consolidating a lot of opposition. And then there's a woman we have here locally, Jeanette Dudeman, who's really one of the stalwart leaders of this tremendous opt-out rebellion that we've had in New York State, where over 225,000 students refused to take the tests, and she helped organize the moms who brought out that response and has more or less fought the authorities in New York State, the governor and the head of the state education board and the Board of Regents. She's fought them to a standoff where they're having to retreat because of the opposition. That's wonderful. And we've had some people like Leonie Hameson, who has been fighting for small class size matters for like 15 years or more, and she's like very, very brave and very, very valuable. And we have tremendous bloggers that are keeping everyone informed and have figured out how to use the internet to rally opposition from the bottom up. And that's Anthony Cody with his Living in Dialogue. And here in the East, we have Bob Braun, who runs a wonderful education column. And we have the phenomenal Mercedes Schneider down in Louisiana, who seems to turn out a book every summer, a phenomenal book and extraordinary research, and from whose blog I follow and learn something from all the time. Then there's Peggy Robertson and Mourner McDermott, who have been leading United Opt Out with annual conferences, and to which I spoke with Stephen Krashen last year, and Stephen himself is constantly writing letters to the editor, to the major newspapers, to correct all the miscoverage of this education war. We have Ken Praviti, who is a wonderful blogger, and we have Mark Nason, also in the East, here's a blogger. But then also there are, like, for the last 30 years, there are three people who've been friends and colleagues of mine that started Rethinking Schools on the kitchen table of one of their kitchens in 1985. And the Rethinking Schools trio that I always honor is Bill Bigelow and Linda Christensen from Oregon and Bob Peterson from Milwaukee, who's now the president of the Milwaukee NEA. So I feel like I'm surrounded by folks who are my heroes and from whom I'm constantly reading every day material that makes it possible to grow the opposition and to turn the corner. And I think we're making important headway despite all the wealth and power being on the other side.
Most of those people that you named have been on the War Report.
Yes.
Some
yes.
of them several times. So, now, but you have not mentioned you.
Oh, okay. So, you know, I got started a very long time ago, 45 years ago. I was born in the working class, and my father was a high school dropout. He made it through the ninth grade, and he managed to get trained as a sheet metal worker. So he picked up a craft, and that made all the difference because craft labor is always paid more than factory line labor. So he made it through the Depression, knocking around here and there and getting into lots of, battles, this and that, just from gangsters trying to take over small unions and this and that. And then he went to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard during two wars and so on. And I grew up in the South Bronx in a very kind of like a working class home. And so, you know, there's only a few things you can do to climb up. You can be very good at sports. You can have a very, very good singing voice. You can be really good at crime. Or what? Or you can be smart and climb up to
school. So you pick crime?
Yeah, I pick crime, right? So I wasn't good at anything except, using my head. And I was very good with reading and writing. So, you know, I was one of those who just, one of the very few who actually got a Ph.D. So I got a Ph.D., and then I started teaching and started pre-med. But then what happened was I bounced out of science into humanities and eventually studied literature. But when I graduated with a PhD in 1971, the job market for college graduates collapsed, and it has not yet recovered. So we've really been in a collapsed job market for the last 40, 45 years. So all this thing, these bogus claims by the Common Core of having our students college and career ready is ridiculous, because the job market has not rewarded our college graduates for their achievements for the last 45 years, and it will not be able to do so in the coming years. What we have to demand is that the job market become graduate ready, that the job market is not prepared to pay and hire our graduates at levels that are equal to their achievements. In fact, probably some of your folks have already mentioned that the tech billionaires like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg have been campaigning in Congress to have what they call H-1B visas expanded. These are special visas that allow the tech billionaires to hire cheap labor, cheap graduates from, say, the Indian institutes of technology. These are very, very good graduates. They're English-speaking, very smart young people. But when they're hired and offered an H-1B visa to come to work in America, these folks are paid 25% less than our young people who are hired as computer grads out of American colleges. So there's a tremendous advantage to the tech billionaires. So if we look, lift up the lid and look under the hood, we can see that, in fact, there is no such thing as a college and career ready. We're being misled, and we have to change the story. So when the job market collapsed, I wasn't able to find a job, so I thought I would be unemployed for a while. But at the last minute, I got hired at a very marginal community college in the City University of New York. And of course, being from the working class, I'm glad to have a paycheck for anything. So I took the job and went to work and discovered that it was a very interesting job, because it was all working class students who were just first admitted to higher education under open admissions, which means that in prior years they would not have been allowed into college. So they were the young folks whose school had more or less given very little attention to, and for whom intellectual life was, not that big a preoccupation. So it became very, it intrigued me, because I came from the same class that they did, that here I was, I became a PhD and intellectual, and I published and so on. And now I was reconnecting with young people from the same class I grew up in who were not the successes in school. So how could I make the connection and to do something to figure out that that intellectual life could become something exhilarating, compelling, inspiring, empowering, that could change, their sense of who they were in the world, and all the ideals of a young teacher. So I started experimenting with different ways.
Let me stop you for a second. Okay.
Right.
One of my first question was going to be, when did you decide you wanted to be a teacher and why? You pretty much have answered that now, but I want to make sure. Your family background, which I won't say similar to mine, because my father never could read or write, never went to school a day in his life. People who've been listening to the show, they know that.
Really?
And my mother had about an eighth grade education, and both were from southern Illinois, and moved up to Detroit during World War II. The whole story, that's when I was born, and you were born a couple years after me.
Right.
But they had this thing that they wanted me to have an education, because they recognized the value of having an education. And I guess it was at the right time, too, when science was coming on strong and medicine was coming on strong, that everybody was beginning to believe in science and education and et cetera. So that's how I got started. So we have that similarity there. Now,
yes.
Mm-hmm. You in your classroom, you're teaching people like yourself. It has to be exhilarating. I got that. Now you decide you want to maybe make this your career.
Mm-hmm.
From that point of making that decision that you want to make it your career, what kind of teacher were you going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Because I got there's a back end question to this, and
okay.
I'll give you that back end question now. The back end question is critical pedagogy. That's what we know you about.
Right.
But I don't want to get to that yet. I want how you started off teaching and how you got to that.
Right. So, I came of age in the late 60s and early 70s, a long time ago, when building a new world and changing the status quo were ideas whose time had come and inspired, hundreds of thousands of young people, many on campuses and so on. So I came of age in a very utopian time where we thought that, we were going to, change poverty and war and inequality and so on, and racism. So those ideals inspired me when I was in graduate school as a graduate teacher to try to use them in some way, but also to figure out that when we're looking, when we're studying something, how do we know what questions need to be asked about anything that we're looking at? That was where I started from when I was in my very young 20s. But when I got to the working class college, I was very startled by the students because I thought they brought a lot of strength and intelligence to the classroom that neither they or anyone else had taken seriously in an educational way. That is, they were like pretty smart people, but not scholarly and so on. So I began to ask myself some questions. If I want them to look very carefully at anything we study, I had to ask myself, what do I do when I write? When I write, what do I do? And when I think, how do I think about things? And what questions pop up in my mind? So I began to pay a lot of close attention to the way my intellect worked and how I had learned to think critically about things. And then I began to try to test ways in which to provide activities in the classroom that would focus the students' attention on these same skills or habits or orientations towards critical thinking about whatever we were studying. The next thing is, I was very young then, and so I began to, I lived in the same neighborhoods as they did, and I also played sports with them in the park, played basketball in the park, so I had a lot, and I ate in the diners that they in, and ate at the bakeries and so on. So I was more or less just part of their neighborhood, and that taught me a lot about how people talk to each other in everyday life and what were the kind of words that kept popping up and themes that kept popping up and how did they use language. So I could pose that in class and so on. So that started to intrigue me, the task of making available to all the students that, not all the students, but to the kinds of folks that I had left behind in my neighborhood. When I left my neighborhood and I was admitted to the Bronx High School of Science, the special elite high school, public high school, right? That's when I left my neighborhood and I lost touch with the kids I grew up with. So now as a teacher, I was back with all those kind of folks. And I kept wondering, okay, so I went through a very elite education through high school and 9 years of university. So what does it mean to now provide the access to that for the students that I was working, that I was now teaching for? I found this very difficult, and I made a lot of mistakes and a lot of blunders and dead ends. I just tested this and tested that. And the thing is that the students were very generous in tolerating my confusion. that for some reason. I was very happy to be there, and I must have broadcast a lot of pleasure in being their teacher. And they seemed very willing to try all kinds of things that I asked. And they, in those days, 45 years ago, students that I was teaching were taking part. They were participating. So they gave me a very big chance that I'm very grateful to test lots of different things and start getting a feel for what, you know, what seemed to be making a making a difference. And that that project has preoccupied me for 45 years, just trying to get better at it, to take the folks for whom the least educational provisions are made, and then work with those folks to develop the most developed intelligence and sharpest critical perceptions and very very strong interests in civic action and in social themes like inequality and racism and gender inequality and how who was controlling the development of our city and why this building suddenly appeared over here instead of this and stuff like that. So it just kept intriguing me, and more or less I discovered that this is a very hard thing to do, and that it's probably going to take a lifetime to get a feel for it.
At that point, or when did you hit on the notion of, first of all, just the word critical? Because where I'm heading is the pedagogy. Most people don't have the slightest idea what the word means.
Mm-hmm.
I know I didn't in the very beginning. And then when you add to it critical pedagogy, how did you get there? That's where I'm trying to lead us. So let's start with, it sounds like the critical, well, you explain it. You're the expert.
You know,
here.
It's like, so, you know, critical, the word critical, everyone is free to define the word critical any way you like. And so what we have to do is we have to say what we mean by it, and then we have to be consistent in the way we talk about it and how we act on it, and that's okay. So everybody can own his or her own definition of what it means to be critical. Now, I have mine, and it emerged actually because of the, you know, the experiences I had in the 1960s and 70s in the very powerful mass movements of that time against the war in Vietnam, for ecology. Earth Day was in April 1970 for the first time. And I went to the first marches in August of 1970 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of women's voting and so on. So, and then there were the Gray Panthers movement and so on. So we all kinds of mass movements were erupting from below and filling the stage of history. The people, folks from below, were filling the stage of history with their demands and putting the status quo on the defensive. And it was a great time to be young. So I grew up thinking that to be critical is to be involved in society and to try to correct things that were wrong, and that to look carefully at how things are working and what things are wrong and why are they like that and how do you make them better. So it always had a very social context for me, because I came of age in this great period where everything was being questioned. Where everything was open to question, and the folks, the billionaires who are now at the top of the heap and more or less dominating school policy and economic policy and so on, they're setting the agenda for what we talk about in society. But it was very different 45 years ago. The agenda was being set from below, from the bottom up, and the folks at the top had to keep responding to the assertions and the expectations that were articulated from the bottom up. So that's how critical came to. That's what critical came to mean to me. That you were a critical citizen in society who looked around and took responsibility for making your world better, and that you had to fearlessly face what was wrong. Try to figure out where it came from, how did it come out to be like this, and how did it operate, and what did the folks do to change it? That's how I understand critical. Now, critical,
pedagogy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Pedagogy.
What's that?
The word pedagogy.
Oh, yeah, the word pedagogy.
Explain that for the people who have no idea what it is.
Right, so I had that orientation. So here I am. I want to be a critical citizen in society who takes responsibility for the things going on in my culture and the world and does something to make things better, okay? So now not everybody wants to do that. So then how does education become an instrument, a way of of inviting other folks to look out in their world and make deep meaning about what's going on around here, how did it get like this, what's good about it, what's not good about it, and what are the wisest, most sensible things to do about that. So now that's a critical orientation to the world, and I absorbed it my participation in mass movements. But by the 1970s, these mass movements were in steep decline. So the opportunity for lots and lots of young folks to learn that through movements was sharply curtailed. And the scene of activity shifted for me, although I joined whatever opposition or movements were around. The scene began for me to become like a classroom scene. And pedagogy means that I sit down and I think of what's a curriculum that will invite students to develop critical habits of mind and a civic orientation for wanting to study their world, figure out what's going on, and make it better. So how does classroom work? What kind of pedagogy will invite students and inspire them to get into them? So it's not a pedagogy where I'm doing all the talking, like now on this interview here with you, because this is you and me, and we're talking to folks listening, so I'm doing a lot of talking. But I began to learn year by year when I was much, much younger that I had to give priority to a student expression because it was a mistake for me to talk them into something or else, that was not the proper way to proceed. And that I discovered that I had to pose problems or compelling questions about some vital interests that are surrounding us that they acknowledged were interesting and important questions in which they had something to say about before I had anything to say about it, that I had to pose a question. So this pedagogy began to emerge, a pedagogy of problem posing, of dialogue, of giving priority to student expression, to asking the students to create what I call the unofficial text, which is everything they think and say and write, before I enter with what I call my voice, which I call the official text, because I am so overeducated and I've done so much reading. The way I speak and talk about the world is extremely different than the way they do. So as soon as I start talking with my overeducated voice, they stop talking, and they think that the education means listening to the teacher and writing down what he says or she says instead of grappling with these issues on their own. Anyhow, what I'm trying to explain here is what I struggled with 45 years ago in trying to figure out a classroom process, which means pedagogy. What did I do in the classroom to use an hour or a two-hour session effectively so that students themselves became actors and responsible for making education happen with me, that I didn't want to do education to them.
Here. I was asking a question. I was leading you to a particular place.
Yes.
You meet a particular super famous person.
Yes. Right.
You write a book with this person.
Right.
I want to know, had you started your approach to pedagogy, critical pedagogy, before you met this person? And if so, how did you and this person meet?
and what influence he had on you after that.
That's
Tell the people who we're
talking
about.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I had the great fortune, great good fortune to spend most of a decade working with Paulo Freire, the legendary educator from Brazil. And that was from the 80s to the early 90s. And but, you know, I started teaching at this community college in 1971. So I did not know about Paulo Freire when I started teaching, that I intuitively moved in this direction through my own sense of, John Dewey says? John Dewey says philosophy or critical reflection is thinking what the known requires of us. So I spent hours and hours just considering what's going on in these classrooms where the results were so pitiful in the beginning. And I thought, this is not working. And then I kept talking to other teachers. I set up a staff development seminar that met every week for 5 years at my community college, where we taught each other this and that and so on and so on. But then as I went on from year to year, certain things began to appear as useful to do, like this problem-posing pedagogy and this these lessons based in themes that provoke students into critical reflection on civic concerns and so on. So I began to write and publish an article here and there on my teaching and so on. And then one of the teachers who worked at my community college said to me, he says, you know, you ought to read this book by a Brazilian named Paulo Freire. He does what you're doing, he says to me. So this was like about the third year or so that I had been like testing this approach or that approach. So about the third or fourth year, I bought Pedagogy of the Press at the Paulo Freire's most famous book is Pedagogy of the Press. It was came out in Mexico in 1968, and then it was translated and published in English in 1970, and it's probably in 30 or 40 languages by now, and has been through umpteen editions. So I bought the book around 1974, and I started reading it, and I said, "Well, this is very interesting. This is what I've been looking for. This is seems to speak to what I'm struggling with here about critical pedagogy and a critical orientation to the experience that you have and trying to study its history so you can overcome it and things like that, and empowering students and the use of dialogue and problem themes and so on. So I started reading more Paulo Freire in the 70s and as time went on. And then I wrote my first book in 1979 called Critical Teaching and Everyday Life, and it came out. And at that time, I was traveling all around the country, and I traveled around the country for 30 years. I went everywhere. I visited tons and tons of campuses, and I gave workshops for teachers and lectures to professors and taught model classes and what have you. And so I kept meeting lots and lots of people here and there. And then when the book came out, I was invited to address this seminar about the book and so on and so on. But the Paulo Freire's youngest son was a student at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And so he tended to visit Ann Arbor because he wanted to see his son, you know, and say hello and what, how are you? And one of his visits to Ann Arbor, one of the there was a community college program there that I was in residence. I spoke for about a few days to where community college teachers were going to come in for a non-research doctorate. It was called the Doctor of Arts, that they wouldn't have to do a traditional research PhD, but would do a different study. So they invited me in as the first speaker there because they read my book, Critical Teaching in Everyday Life, and they thought, aha, here's somebody who teaches at a community college and thinks that our job matters. You know, let's have him here. So I went out there. And one of the teachers there handed Paulo Freire a copy of my book, Critical Teaching in Everyday Life, and said, somebody in America, you know, likes what you do or something like that, you know. Then Paulo Freire took it back to Brazil, and apparently he read it because he sent me a letter. He sent me, I opened my mailbox in New York, and out pops a letter from Brazil. I see a very strange stamp on it. I look at the return address. It says Paulo Freire, and I have a cardiac arrest and hit the floor, and the super has to pick me up and help me up to the apartment. I read the letter, and it's a very sweet, very cordial letter from Paulo Freire saying he thanks me for all the wonderful words that I put in the book and for, you know, doing this and that and so on. And so on. So I wrote him back. And then some months later, I got a call from him. He was in residence at Stanford in 1982 in the summer. He was doing a summer-long seminar there. And he asked me to fly out to Stanford to do the seminar with him, to be in residence with him. Just turned out I was in the middle of writing another book just when he called, and I had a deadline, and I couldn't get away, you know, so on. So he said 6 months later he's going to be in Amherst, Massachusetts, also in residence, and could I join him there? So I said, yes, I'll come, whatever. So 6 months later I went up to Amherst and met him for the first time, and we had a wonderful, I went up there, wound up making three trips up there, and we got along great and had all this great conversations and, you know, this event and that event and all kinds of assemblies and talks and what have you. So at the end, you know, in my youthful exuberance, I said, Paulo, you know, you and I, we should do a book together. So he said, let's start tomorrow. That's what he said. He says, we start tomorrow. Tomorrow morning you come to my apartment, we begin. So, you know, I was overwhelmed. So next morning I came to his apartment on campus and we started planning. Anyhow, for the next year or two, I followed him. He traveled a lot in those days, all over the world. Anytime he was in North America, I flew to wherever he was, and we worked on the book for the next 2 years. And the book is called The Pedagogy for Liberation, and it's based in the questions that teachers kept asking as I traveled around the country about how to do critical pedagogy. That what is problem posing? What is a dialogic method of teaching? How do you use student themes and so on? So we based each chapter in the book on a question that I took away with me from all these meetings around the country that I had with teachers, these sessions. And he thought that was very good. That's exactly what we should do. And so each chapter begins with a key question that was asked often, that a lot of teachers kept asking about. They were afraid. That what do you do with your fear of being, you know, being punished for doing this kind of thing? So we have one chapter talked about fear, that's about fear and risk, and how to face fear and risk in trying this kind of education. So we worked on it for 2 years, and then in 1986 it was published, and it became the first. He called it a talking book because the production was that I would start by posing a question, and we would talk for a few hours, and it would be taped. Then I would go home with the tapes, and I would edit the tapes and send him an edited transcript. Then we would meet again, and then we would retape and re-edit the transcript. Then we would begin to add citations and references and expand on ideas that we thought were not well developed, take out stuff that we thought was not useful. And so we kept editing the transcript again and again over 2 years until we got chapters that we thought were useful. The book came out. He said, this is our talking book, and it's the first one that he's done with a collaborator, and we published it in
1986, November 1986.
Right. Came out in 86, and it's gone through 10 printings. It just keeps, yeah, go ahead.
Because we got a few more questions, and yeah, we're down to about 15, 20 minutes.
Okay.
Now, critical pedagogy, if you can tie it to wanting to change the world, you can tie it to initiating social change, and it comes from the classroom.
Yes.
You use it in the classroom.
Right.
Let's fast forward to today. I would argue that, hypothetically, you are the person that they had in mind when they got behind closed doors and came up with Common Core. We want to kill this guy named Ira and his critical pedagogy he is screwing up a lot of things. We want to standardize his curriculum, get rid of the question, get rid of the thinking, and make it mechanical and et cetera. You know, that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but basically, I swear I see it. And the question to you would be, how do you see your methodology as it come up against Common Core?
Yes, right.
Compatible,
okay.
Incompatible?
Yes. It's incompatible, and I think you're absolutely right that Common Core is invented far away from classrooms by people who do not know the teachers, the schools, the communities, or the families, or the conditions, or the language uses of the people in all of America's 15,000 school districts, and they get a single pedagogy of what Susan Ohanian called one size fits all. And we know that that's a bogus way to teach. So critical pedagogy is, I practice it, and as Paulo Freire theorized, wrote about it. It has a very strong foundation in John Dewey. John Dewey wrote 100 years ago that all serious study has to begin with materials that are familiar to the students. And John Dewey put it this way. He said, an ounce of experience is worth more than a ton of theory. That's how he summarized his view on the powerful importance of using student experience as the starting point for a long project or long study, a long inquiry into something. Now, Paulo Freire acknowledged that he stands on John Dewey's shoulders, and Paulo Freire then took John Dewey's method, father, as he was the next generation to develop it, and to put it in the context of power relations in society, and to take it out of the classroom and to address, in his society, illiterate peasants and workers, and so on. So the starting point of a serious study is it begins where the students are and addresses them at their level of understanding and the way they use language. John Dewey next said that the responsibility of the educator was to structure academic subject matter into the experience of students. That is, our goal was to introduce students to subject matter and to knowledge and to books and ideas and theories that are not generated in everyday experience, that don't come out of daily life. And John Dewey understood that. A few things. First, he said this, that that the explanation for everyday life does not come out of everyday life. That is, in everyday life, you can't figure out why everyday life is like this, except in some very abstract ways, and so on. That is, everyday life does not have an instruction in history, and in political science, and in sociology, that can help us take a step back from the nature of experience and say, oh, things are like this because they evolved from here to there this way, and things are now like this because certain people with a lot of power want to keep it that way, and so on. And those of us who want it different, here's other things we can do differently. So Dewey thought that the purpose of education was to acquaint students with explanations and ways of knowing their everyday life that were not available in everyday life, and that was the task, the job of the teacher, who brought academic bodies of knowledge and developed subject matters and all kinds of disciplines to the classroom that he or she, the teacher, had to figure out how to structure into the ongoing experiences of the students. The students were studied to discover how do they talk, how do they live, what do they think about things, how do they examine whatever we're looking at. then into all that material, the teacher then has
Ira,
to figure out. Yeah.
Let me come back in because we're beginning to less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
In essence,
yeah,
the question was, and you have already answered it, is that critical pedagogy is in direct opposition to Common Core and high-stakes testing.
Yes. Yes, as I practice it now, other folks don't think so. There are some people who do critical pedagogy that think that the job of the teacher is to begin with organized subject matter that we learned in our graduate classes. My sense is that we have to integrate all this subject matter into an ongoing project that inspires the students based in their interests. And for Paulo Freire named this as the generative themes, that our study of students taught us what matters most to students, and then we developed the curriculum based in the themes that we learn from them. And once we represent those themes to them, we also integrate bodies of knowledge that help explain what those themes are all about. So
okay.
The teacher enters secondly, yes.
Let's move to where we are today, and that is, how does all that you've said so far tie into the war on public education as it is today?
Mm-hmm.
And more specifically, I had said in my writing of what this show is going to be about is how does this serve the soul and survival of public education in the classroom? And the question I had in mind at that time was, you have spent a lifetime almost dealing with saving education, changing education, the role of education in society, the role of education for the student. All of that right now is being threatened. And so what does critical pedagogy, what does IRA do now?
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right that the Common Core standards and the PARC tests and the SBA tests are all trying to take control of the national curriculum so as to standardize it in one kind of curriculum that everyone uses everywhere. And the tests that are being developed, the standardized tests, are going to be used to enforce that curriculum, and schools will be punished, and teachers will be punished, and students will be punished unless you teach this material that the authorities say must be learned in this way. Now, the pedagogy that I talk about, the critical pedagogy, is a whole different student-centered way to develop critical knowledge, deep thinking skills and habits of inquiry, orientations to civic responsibility, and so on and so on. But it begins from the students and works with the way the students are learning. The learning that the students display to the teacher becomes the material that we use for the next lesson. That cannot be, and this is what I often say, that this kind of classroom, the classrooms that we need, cannot be controlled from the outside and cannot be defended from the inside. And this matters a great deal to me. And what I mean by that is that the Common Core is an attempt to control all of our classrooms from the outside from people who are not educators and from people who are not part of the communities that they are imposing these tests and curricula on. So that's the outside control that cannot possibly work, because professional educators inside the classroom must listen carefully to the students they're working with and develop curricula that fit the needs and the developmental stages of the students that they're working with. Now, the second point. What's that?
What's your second point?
The second point is that the right to do that, the power to do that, means that, which we don't have, means that these classrooms that we need, where teachers work closely with students and build the curriculum around the students' development and language use, that right cannot be defended from inside the classroom. Because if we stay only in the classroom, the forces, the authorities from the outside, will surround us and invade us and conquer us. So that all of us who believe that a different kind of education is possible and necessary, that our teachers and our students are being abused, that our district tax levies and our funds are being wasted on useless technology and useless testing, that we must leave the classroom, all us teachers, and we must go out into political society and start campaigning for the right way to do things, which means that what I call is create the conditions for pedagogy, create the conditions for learning, create the conditions for classroom study. Those conditions do not exist now because the outside authorities are on the warpath.
Okay.
And under the pressure of the billionaires who have a great deal of wealth and power to throw at us and will gain more wealth from this whole regime, they're outside the classroom. And they have the power now to derange the classroom. So we can't defend the classroom by staying inside. That we have to leave the classroom and wage war in political society to stop them. And outside the classroom is where we will gain the power needed to create the conditions for the pedagogy that's needed. And that's why this whole movement from below for United Opt Out is so crucial, because it exactly represents the creating the conditions for pedagogy and stopping outside the classroom, stopping the authorities from invading the classroom with all the wrong tools.
Well, that last part is where I was going in terms of what are you doing and your involvement with United Opt Out as a way to defend public education, as also a way to keep critical pedagogy in all classrooms all across the country, all grades. So you brought us pretty much full circle in terms of the questions that I wanted to pose and hear your response. One last question. Make this a 30-second one.
Okay.
Do you think we'll ever be able to go back to universal critical pedagogy in our public school system?
Okay. We never had universal critical pedagogy in our school system. That our school system presented classroom teachers with more autonomy than they now have. And that autonomy of the professional educator has been under attack for 10 years or more by the Common Core crowd. So what we have to do is the war that we're waging to stop the Common Core and all the standardized testing is going to create the conditions for getting it right. But now getting it right is going to be our next project. That after we push back all the forces that have been deranging and invading and looting our public sector, after we push them back, we're going to have to look each other in the face and say, okay, look, we've won some breathing room and we have some space to behave like professional educators and very concerned parents. So what are the things that we need to do most? We need small class size. We need the professional educators to have smaller classes so that they can attend to the actual development that they witness in each student.
Ira, I have to stop you. Our
time's out. Okay.
Time is up. Let me say this, folks. There will not be a War Report show next Sunday at this time. War Report will come back the first Sunday in September the 6th, and we'll resume our weekly schedule at that point. So, everyone, thanks for coming to War today. Thank those, again, who said happy birthday to me, and hope everyone have a good rest of the summer, and we'll come back in 2 weeks, and we can pick up just where we're leaving off. With that, I say goodbye and have a good Sunday.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.